Investors Chronicle.
Companies and Markets Show, welcome back. It is Thursday, the 14th of July, around 10 a.m. as we record, a bit earlier today than normal. On the pod today, we've got Alex Newman, Mark Robinson, Arthur Sands, and Alex Hamer, all hosted as normal by Dan Jones. Hi, Dan. What's coming up today?
Hi, John. We've got an interesting day today. We are speaking about Haleon, the big listing due to list on Monday in the UK. We're talking about our cover feature on psychedelics and how they could perhaps provide some medical or mental health breakthroughs, and the companies looking to back that niche. And then we are talking about the European energy crunch and what the possibility of the gas being turned off might mean for the likes of Germany and others.
Lovely stuff. Thanks, Dan. Well, before we get there, a quick rundown from the week that has been. On Wednesday, the euro fell to parity with the US dollar for the first time in two decades. The global backdrop has seen investors rally to the perceived safety of the dollar, while the euro has kept slipping. The ECB were keen to point out it's the dollar which is strong rather than the euro being weak. The dollar has hit a 20-year high. Lots of Twitter versus Elon Musk news this week, with the company pressing ahead in suing the billionaire over his attempts to exit an agreed $44 billion takeover deal. Musk's exit strategy is a model of hypocrisy, the lawsuit said, accusing the billionaire of making, quote, bad faith arguments against Twitter and carrying out, quote, public and misleading attacks. Couple of companies' bits. Russian operating gold miner Petropavlovsk has had its shares suspended on Tuesday morning. It came after the company called in administrators after deciding there was no chance it would be able to find the $200 million needed to pay back Gazprom Bank, which demanded full loan repayment in April. Meanwhile, shares in fashion brand Jewels dropped 20% on Monday after the company confirmed it had sought the help of debt advisors. Inflation updates from the US. Wednesday saw CPI hit 9.1% for June, which is plus 1.3% month on month. It's left the Fed under pressure to hike rates by a full percentage point after the 9.1% figure exceeded analyst expectations. Markets, FTSE 100 down just over a percent on the week so far. Similar story on Wall Street and in Europe at time of recording.
Thank you, John. Yes, we are starting with Haleon, the spin-off from GlaxoSmithKline. As I said earlier, it's due to list on Monday. And this is, you know, this is the biggest listing for about a decade since Glencore. The exact size of it we might come to in a minute. This is quite an interesting moment, I think, certainly for GlaxoSmithKline shareholders, who will receive one share in Haleon for every GSK share they own. The question being, obviously, what is the outlook for this company, this newly formed company? It's a consumer health business. There's a few of them around in the UK, in Europe, in the US. Not the most thrilling business, but that kind of, you know, hopefully reliable giant is perhaps what we could do with a bit more of right now. Mark Robinson, our company's editor, and Alex Newman, our ideas editor, are here to discuss. Mark, what's your take on the company to begin with? And maybe if you could just talk about, you know, what it does, and we can go from there, I think.
Yeah, okay. It's sort of, you could say it's the consumer arm of GSK at the moment. Features a lot of extremely well-known brands in the UK and abroad, the likes of Voltaren, Sensodyne, and Panadol, which everyone out there will know. The rationale behind the deal is that it allows GSK to purely focus on biopharmaceuticals. I guess that in some respects reflects ongoing technological change as well, and the fact that it will need to invest more time in driving that side of the business. The commercial rationale is possibly less clear, given that the consumer side of the business is still performing. I know it's come under some criticism within these pages in the past by our colleague Julian Hoffman. But I think in some respects that's down to operational or management issues. At any rate, management said that over the next 5 years they expect to deliver compound annual growth of more than 5%. adjusted operating profit of more than 10%. Given what's happened over the last couple of years or so, I think that's quite realistic in a sense. At the moment, the business operates over five categories. On the main, oral health accounts for 29% of revenue. Pain relief, Panadol, as I mentioned before, about 23%. Digestive health, about a fifth. Vitamins, minerals, and supplements, 15.7%. And respiratory health, about 12%. Looking at the operating profit from last time around, the consumer healthcare segment of the business contributed about 28% of operating profits, which is more than respectable, really. It's also the growth rate over the last financial year was also impressive. I think one of the things to come out of this as well is the fact that you would get the impression that OTC products are somehow sort of less profitable in a sense. And of course, the margins are slightly lower over time. You look at products such as Zevirax, which has been one of Pfizer's most profitable products over the last couple of decades or so. And Jennifer Johnson, in her article, pointed to the importance of drugs that go from prescription to over-the-counter switching. Again, they can be extremely profitable. Viagra actually springs to mind because that's recently become available over the counter, I'm told. And the consumer healthcare business represents about 28% of operating profits at stand. Over the last financial year, that was up by 56% on a constant exchange rate basis. The margin itself is about 23.3%. Now, that's a couple of points down on vaccines and pharma, but that's minimal, really. And it comes down to what is the rationale behind it? I guess it's focusing, as I said before, just focusing on the higher margin parts of the business. But as with all these kinds of deals, they're not made in isolation, and the board members would have been taking advice from their financial advisors there as well. And I've always thought that there's incentives for financial advisors to split businesses and then sew them back together again. So I don't know. I have no real opinion as to whether this will work out. I'm sure both arms of the company will do quite well, but it generates cash flow, and I'm just wondering if those cash flows are going to be consistent. As consistent from the vaccine and pharma parts of the business.
Yeah, maybe we'll come back to the fundamentals in a moment. That prescription to over-the-counter side of things is something that Haleon seems to have been talking up its own ability to do that. He says it has a couple of more coming down the pipeline in, well, 2 or 3 years' time, which could add, 1 or 2 percentage points to its 4 to 6 percentage point annual percentage annual growth. So, it's really pinning some hope on that. But as you kind of alluded to, the corporate backstory is quite interesting here, isn't it? Because this is obviously a business for which GSK rejected a £50 billion bid from Unilever earlier this year. So, now it's listing. In some way, the pressure is on management to, justify their existence. The pressure is perhaps on GSK to show that not that they'll have much of a hand in it anymore, but just to show that they made the right decision to reject Unilever's bid. Unilever itself obviously came in for a huge amount of criticism from its own shareholders for bidding for the company. Alex, so how do you see the stakes there in terms of where it might price and what it might say about the respective strategies of these consumer giants, these pharma giants, and the potential for M&A down the line as well, I suppose.
A lot to answer there. I'm going to sit on the fence in terms of pricing evaluation because I'll inevitably be proven wrong in a couple of days' time when it does list. But I suppose one of the big considerations, regardless of how it prices immediately for GSK shareholders, is what's going to happen to the shares in the next few months. And there's quite a big risk. So for each one share of you own in GSK, you'll be getting one share in Haleon. I think one of the principal issues is the large overhang that that is in the shares and the selling pressure which might come. So Pfizer will own a 32% stake in the business, and GSK says it plans to retain a 14% stake as well, which it's going to sell off over time. But that's quite a big stock overhang. So regardless of the valuation, the pricing, I don't think this is likely to be a company which we're going to, you know, which is going to pop, regardless of how benign markets prove to be for its products. You know, saying that, it is the side of the business which is perhaps has slightly more defensive qualities to it. So that's going to, in theory, award it, you know, a decent multiple. Though the multiples within the consumer healthcare space are so wide. I think it's looking at before we came on to talk, is something between 14 and 33 times forward earnings, depending on which peer you look at. So it's quite a wide valuation. And yes, there are, you know, there are various outlooks you can put on how Sensodyne is going to do. You know, these quite sort of stodgy brands and the pricing power some of these products have, which is pretty good, and people don't tend to dispose of the need to brush their teeth in recessions. But at the same time, as the piece that Mark alluded to, that Jen wrote last month, sort of previewing Haleon's listing, consumer healthcare groups do struggle generally to maintain these even quite modest growth rates. So 4% sales growth a year is kind of about what you would hope for. Okay, there's lots of efficiencies they can build in, and, you know, pricing power, which means they can get slightly more in terms of return on equity and net profit growth. But yeah, this isn't a business which is going to shoot the lights out. And so I suppose on valuation, I think I would expect it to, though, you know, not want to place all my cards on the table, I'd expect it to sit slightly below GSK's valuation, because GSK, basically the rump business, is going to be the higher risk reward trade-off. So yeah, that's my very, very hedged take on where the valuation is likely to sit and what investors can expect.
I suppose the other thing with, you know, there are some headwinds here we've spoken about, obviously the share overhang, the debt, which, you know, they're really banking on strong cash flows continuing to help improve that situation. But to me, return to one of the many questions I threw at Alex all at once, you know, that there is that possibility of more M&A down the line, you know, a buyer coming in. Unilever, I would imagine, would not want to antagonize shareholders by coming back. But I believe there was some talk of Nestlé and Reckitt making a joint, having a look at some kind of joint bid a few months ago. This does seem like something that could be in play, as big as it will be. You know, it could be in play for one of these giant companies down the line. So that might provide some support, I suppose, that possibility of being taken out almost as quickly as it comes to market. But we will see on that front. Let's move on to our cover story this week. Going from over-the-counter drugs to something a little more exotic. The piece is on psychedelics and the research being done in that area with regard to their potential ability to help with mental health, to help with things like depression, anxiety, things like that. There are a small but increasing number of listed companies, largely in the US, but a couple in the UK too, who are looking at this kind of area. Arthur Sands has written the piece. Arthur, why don't we start? You know, this is obviously an area from an investment point of view that is quite unfamiliar to a lot of people. Why don't we start by sort of talking about the potential and what these companies are trying to do?
Yeah, thanks, Dan. Basically, what they're trying to do is treat anxiety, depression, addiction, which I guess all sort of stem from a similar root cause, which is often a feeling of sort of dislocation and isolation. That has been on the rise in the last few decades, and there was that paper out of Princeton about rising deaths of despair in the US, and it's that's often basically drug and alcohol overdoses. And then when I was looking at which I didn't actually realize beforehand, when I was looking at the sort of recent data for this article, I saw there's been a massive tick up in deaths of despair, even though it's been accelerating recently. The acceleration sped up again during the pandemic, and the traditional way to treat depression is with these SSRIs. So like the first one was invented by Eli Lilly in the 70s, and that was Prozac, and that's still a really, really popular one. There's Zoloft, which is another really popular one, which is made by Pfizer. And like around 15% of Americans are taking these drugs, and the market size for these antidepressants is like $15.6 billion at the moment and expected to rise to $21 billion in 2030. So it's basically the market for treating depression and anxiety is huge, and it's growing. But if your market is growing massively and the more and more people are depressed, like how good are these drugs that you're giving them? Presumably not hugely effective. A potential solution to this problem are psychedelics. And the one that's getting the most research into it is psilocybin, and that's the molecule that you'll find in magic mushrooms. The company that I talked to most closely about this is a company called Cybin, which is listed in America last year. And basically what they've done is they've taken the sort of molecule from psilocybin that has these, creates these psychedelic effects, and they've isolated it and sort of trying to turn it into like a patented drug. And I talked to the CEO of Cybin, a guy called Doug Drysdale, and he explained how it worked to me. And basically the problem they have with just giving people a mushroom is that these trips take a really long time. Like it takes an hour for it to start and they can last for 6 hours. With LSD, the trips can last like 12 hours. So if you're trying to get treatment, this time periods are pretty unreasonable. Like if you're like, oh yeah, I'm going to go in and see my psychiatrist and then I'm going to sit with them for 12 hours while we work through this. So the point of what they're trying to do with this molecule at Cybin is they're trying to make it sort of metabolize faster. So faster onset, and then also sort of the trip to finish. And when I say trip, I guess just like the what they call them, psychedelic experience. And when the trip to finish faster, and then you do it in conjunction, you'll sit with like a therapist. And the therapist actually doesn't ask you loads of questions. It's often a case of sort of the patient closing their eyes, often listening to soothing music, wearing eye masks, and sort of trying to work their way through traumas or what's causing them anxiety. And a few people I talked to actually for this piece were palliative care doctors. I ended up sort of in a Canadian niche of the palliative care sector. So I talked to a lot of Canadian doctors about this and how you can use these drugs to treat end of life anxiety, people that have terminal illnesses. They found it to be pretty successful. I talked to one Canadian doctor who said a few of his patients sort of were asked for magic mushrooms instead of just like, I think to quote him, a bucket load of codeine, which doesn't seem great. So I think so you sort of sit there with your for a while, think about your sort of traumas or what's causing you the anxiety, and then the psychiatrist with you will be there if you have any questions or if you sort of start becoming distressed, because these trips aren't just like fun. They're patients go through a real journey and sort of tackle things that are causing them real anxiety, which probably it doesn't feel great in the moment, but can sort of bring some peace afterwards. I think one of the doctors I talked to in Canada described it as depression's often, or like anxiety, you often sort of ruminating thoughts and you get sort of stuck in a rut. And the nice description I was given of how these drugs work is that sort of there's a new layer of fresh snow over those ruts, and then you can sort of find your new path again. So there's been a bit of a renaissance, yeah, in these drugs in the recent history. And like there was a lot of research into them in the 1960s and 1970s. And then there was the war on drugs and Nancy Reagan, Just Say No. And they were worried that sort of these people would take these drugs and not want to go fight in Vietnam, not be good little capitalists. So they banned them all. But it's been really picking up again this year, the research into them. And that's why sort of these companies, as I mentioned, Cybin, there's another one called Compass Pathways, and another like Atai Life Sciences, who've all listed recently in the US, have started popping up again. But they're still quite far away from producing any revenues. I think most of them sort of predicted to start producing revenues in 2025 or 2026, which does make the sort of valuation case quite tricky, because you're definitely, there's a lot of finger in the wind stuff. But from all the sort of scientific community, there are really strong use cases for these drugs. There's been, and the research into them is picking up a lot, and they're seeing a lot of really positive results. So it might be a case of sort of, I think it will be an important part of psychiatric treatment and treating depression and treating anxiety, and it's clearly becoming a real issue in our society. maybe picking the winners right now in this market is going to be tricky, but if you believe in it, and I feel like I do from the research I did in the piece, then there might be, there's probably going to be some value in maybe.
I suppose there are also perhaps comparisons with the cannabis market as well in the US, which again, you know, it attracts a lot of excitement. Some of these niche sectors, that excitement has come off the boil as it has everywhere this year. But maybe that's, you know, helpful in a way. You know, it allows people to actually focus on what might happen down the line rather than the excessive valuations of the near term, perhaps.
That is true. I think one of the issues possibly is, which, and one of the issues I think they found in the cannabis sector is that it's been illegal for, it was illegal for such a long time that the people that were selling cannabis illegally got really good at selling cannabis illegally. So you could buy illegal cannabis cheaper than you could buy the legal version. So it was difficult for the sort of legal companies to compete with people who've been doing it for years and didn't have to pay any taxes. So it was a lot cheaper for them to do it. And I think maybe that's possibly an issue in this space as well, in the sense that these companies create these molecules because they need to have something that they can patent. You can't patent a mushroom, and you can't patent LSD, which was discovered by Albert Hofmann in the 30s. So they're sort of creating problems that they need to solve so they can create these molecules so they can patent them to make loads of money. Then you talk to people, as I was listening to Paul Stamets, who's a mycologist in Canada who like loves mushrooms, knows everything about mushrooms. And he doesn't think that these companies are actually, their products are going to help anyone more than the mushrooms themselves. They just want to be able to patent these molecules so that they can make a lot of money. So I guess the point I'm making about this equivalent to the cannabis market is that if this stuff starts working and all this scientific research comes out saying this stuff works, what stops people from just like growing their own mushrooms and taking them, or like growing them, or there's, or maybe that an industry will pop up. You can already go to Jamaica and go to a, like a psychiatric retreat where magic mushrooms are legal, take them with guidance, and there are places where you can do this. Maybe things like that pop up in Oregon, and maybe actually it becomes less about one company owning a patent to a magic molecule like Eli Lilly did with Prozac, and it becomes more of a sort of case of people using, I don't know, a more sort of democratized way of treating mental health issues. Maybe that's better, maybe bad from an investor who's looking for one company to make you a ton of cash.
I suppose that's also, it's partly, you know, back to the, in a way, the generics versus, you know, brand products. That might be where the marketing comes in down the line to convince people that they want the you know, the big brand psychedelic, the big brand magic mushroom, if you will. Yeah, it's certainly an interesting area, and one that, you know, I think high growth investors might be interested in keeping tabs on. These terrible puns are coming out all the time now. Yeah, thank you for that, Arthur. It's very interesting. As I say, that is the cover feature this week. There's lots more information on there, lots of discussion of these companies and their fundamentals, and lots of interesting historical information there as well. I learned a lot reading it, and hopefully our listeners will too. We move on though to the reality, the present day reality, and the rather serious issue of energy security. This obviously is on the back of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, and now the prospect of gas supplies to Europe being cut off. They are going to be cut off in the short term, possibly for a little bit longer, depending on how the quote-unquote maintenance of the Nord Stream pipeline goes. And this is starting to be recognized, I think, as a real risk for European society later this year as we head into winter. Alex Hamer, our news editor, wrote about this last week. A big issue for Europe, for European manufacturers, for everyone, possibly, Alex.
Yeah, I mean, to paraphrase Sir Mick Jagger, and to touch on the last subject a bit, it's the gas. The Nord Stream 1 pipeline is off at the moment, has been all week and will be for another few days, hopefully. It'll come back on. It's a tricky situation. I think watching Germany struggle with it has been interesting, if a bit scary. They've started putting backup measures in place if the Russians don't increase gas exports, basically if they don't turn Nord Stream 1 back on. So yesterday, the government has just said that they've pushed back limits to coal and fuel oil power plants operating. So if gas storage levels are quite low as we get into winter, we'll get more burning of coal and fuel oil, and potentially even wood. But that's more on a per house basis. So really reaching back, I guess, in terms of energy technologies. And obviously there's a massive geopolitical element to this, but a key part that's actually going in Germany and other European countries' favour is that Canada, helpfully, where magic mushrooms are legal or soon to be legal or effectively legal, as per the last chat, they will send back a critical part for Nord Stream 1, which has caused a lot of criticism because it's seen to be supporting the Russians and helping them out. But effectively, Canada sending back a turbine part is going to help keep the lights on in Europe. And so far, the impact's already being felt in the futures market. December power prices have spiked recently as well. So I think in the short term for investors, gas prices are still strong. We've seen some more deals coming through this week to try and take advantage of that. For consumers, it's more bad news, unfortunately.
I suppose the other issue is how in these scenarios, and from what I've seen, the scenario analysis in Germany, such a wide range, even among, the regulators, in terms of if Russia's, if the gas does stop there, I think that I saw something saying the German regulator said in 6 of the 7 scenarios, they absolutely do not have enough gas, it will run out. And then someone else published a thing a day later saying actually in 80% of scenarios there'll be no physical scarcity. But you can see, I think, that politicians are getting worried. I think yesterday there was just a piece in the FT talking about the European Commission's gas demand reduction plan draft, which is talking about some of these things which unfortunately have become more common. So basic things such as turning down the heating, compensating industries for curbing gas use. So, if you're a manufacturer, if you're a business in Europe, and, you might have an incentive to curb that use, but at the same time, you're going to be needing that in order to remain a going concern. So it could be a really serious problem. I guess we just don't know yet. And hopefully then there'll be enough ducks in a row ahead of time.
Yeah. And I think one analyst that I spoke to, or who put out a note at the end of last week, phrased this winter as a time when we could possibly muddle through in terms of keeping the lights on, which is a fairly cute phrase for the risk there of not being able to keep the lights on and I guess not muddling through. But I think the demand destruction part of it is really important. I mean, supply has obviously not, is not working out. I think even on the oil side, which is much less critical in Europe right now, the thresholds for which I think it could be Germany or it could be a broader EU group, they'd agreed to only buy a certain amount of Russian oil and tailing off, and they've blown through those self-imposed limitations already. So like the supply is so critical that demand destruction has started and will probably continue as well as we go. And I mean, our Investors Chronicle has been full of stories about, in construction, in manufacturing, retailers, all the in between fun stuff, like, filling up trucks with petrol and diesel, and all those little hits. It does kind of come back to this reliance on Russian oil and gas. And I think, ideas about putting a price cap in are interesting, but it the horse has bolted. And I think trying to impose new limits on a market that is reacting to the hardcore reality of there not being enough gas and oil on the continent is not going to work.
Price capping seems insane. So you haven't got very much oil and gas coming, so you put a price, the point of prices going up is to limit, it's to lower demand for something that you're short of, so then price capping it seems like an insane way to respond to that.
Yeah, I mean, it's the same kind of, you know, stuff that you learn in economic class in uni or even high school, where, you know, to help people with petrol prices, don't cut the tax and increase demand.
Give them money elsewhere in their life to cover the cost that they might have to spend on higher gas prices, but actively encouraging them to spend money on petrol when you haven't got very much of it seems mental.
Yeah. So I think it's quite easy to kind of point and say these policies are not going to work. But it's clear that politicians are floundering.
Yeah, I think that, you know, stuck between a rock and a hard place to an extent, aren't they?
Sure,
I mean,
obviously,
there are all these questions of energy mix and, you know, Germany still rejecting nuclear and turning on the coal power plants back on. But ultimately, as you say, those are kind of medium-term issues anyway. The short-term is what it is, unfortunately. Is it fair to say the UK is not quite as badly affected by this? I mean, I know the UK does export gas to Europe right now. We don't have much storage, but we do have a decent supply at the moment. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, and much less exposed to Russian gas compared to Germany, for example. And there's a system through which the UK can be both importer and exporter of gas to Europe through the and power largely through the interconnected system. But we dodged a bullet last week when the Norwegian, one of the big Norwegian oil fields and gas fields, the government managed to stop a strike, which would have made things a bit worse. So the UK is a little bit insulated, partly because of domestic supply. But I think this idea of trying to, you know, establish domestic supply security or security of supply is... You know, it does make sense, of course, because if it's, you know, on, you know, in UK North Sea, we should have dibs on it. But I mean, the price isn't that different to what you're paying across the channel. But yeah, I think in terms of actually having gas in the pipes, definitely better off than Germany.
I think the It's almost got lost in the last couple of weeks of political high drama. But I mean the news on where the household energy costs are going to go to from October stunned me this week. So I mean, even though it's not quite as acute, obviously, as you know, being reliant on a pipeline to Russia, I think energy prices for households are predicted to go up another 65% in October. So if you an ordinary household is probably paying about £150, if you're paying £150 a month, that's going to be up to £250 by October. And then that's a high conviction prediction from the energy analysts who've been following this and calling it quite well. And then in January it's going to jump again. So I mean, I think this is the possibly underappreciated threat to, you know, even greater threat to discretionary spending and industry as well, because, you know, energy prices are sort of, they're out of control, and it's not really clear how, you know, the sort of solutions that people are talking about, turning Rough, the Rough storage facility back online, if that's gonna fix it in the near term. But I'm pretty worried by it, to be honest.
Well, I think there are any number of ripple effects from the increase in hub prices around the world, just to give you one example as well, is that even if you're a primary producer and you manage to get hold of some fertilizer at the end of autumn, you're going to be paying a much higher price for nitrate-based fertilizers because of the increase in gas prices.
It's already up like fourfold, isn't it, I think?
Exactly. And then you've got the price of diesel on top of that, transporting farming goods. It's not really difficult to see why we're going through this inflationary stage at the moment. And even though the price of crude oil has fallen over the last 3 weeks or so, I think these problems will worsen during the winter months. I think the full impact of inflation, I don't think we're going to get until the first quarter of next year.
It's interesting comparing that with the forecast of inflation peaking in spring next year, which is, you know, paints a pretty dire picture. But even that, if we're coming into a spring where, as you say, UK consumers are spending, over $3,500 a year on power or on an annual basis, and then that goes up again,
So inflation peaks then because demand, aggregate demand, is so destroyed in the economy. I don't know if that's what the economists' predictions are.
Well, this
apparently
is
that rosy.
I mean, without getting overtly political about this as well, this is again a demonstration of when you try and manipulate markets externally, leaving aside the war in Ukraine at the moment. You've got other examples of this in the Netherlands and Sri Lanka, where government invoked agricultural policy almost overnight, or relatively speaking overnight. And you're seeing now physical deficits in agricultural product. Dutch farmers are out on the street because it looks like their livelihoods are just being sort of taken from underneath them. You're going to find a lot more of this as well. But I don't want to get into the rights and wrongs of environmental policy. And
so, what's happened exactly there? What's the subsidies?
It's been going on for a little while now, and it's part of EU policy. It's not a diktat yet, but it's of course the Dutch are ahead of the field in this. It's just a question they can try and reduce the amount of nitrates that go into their soil by about half by the end of this decade. And given the Netherlands is the second largest agricultural exporter in the world, you know, it's a huge sector within that economy. And with this government policy, if it goes unrestricted, will lead to farmers just leaving the land, and very high proportion of farmers. They've tried the same thing in Sri Lanka as well. They wanted to increase their sort of national ESG scores there, but all it's done is led to massive spikes in food prices. And of course, this has been exacerbated by what's going on in Ukraine too. But I just think the governments need to be very careful when they intervene in markets.
I mean, it's also intervening in the soil. You can't just flick a switch and make the soil healthy enough again to support crops and feed without that kind of, you know, fertilizer being needed.
I tell you what, it looks Anglo-Americans' purchase of serious minerals is pretty good now.
That's all, Mark. Or the two marks.
On that note, I think it's fair to say, given all these issues we've raised, that energy policy, for better for worse, is going to be a big feature of the rest of the year, and as it has been for the last 6-12 months too. So we will see how that plays out, and we will keep an eye on it and keep reporting on it in our pages as well. But that is all we have time for today. So thank you to everyone for taking part. Thank you to both Alexes, to Mark and to Arthur and to John. And thank you to you for listening. We will speak to you next week on the next Companies and Markets show.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers, with rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.